if they're coming out of big corporate America, they're going to have a major problem trying to fit in because the cannabis industry changes so rapidly.
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields. With me, as always, is Kellen Finney. And this week, we've got a very special guest, R.W. Navis, executive recruiter and founder of The Canapack. R.W., thanks for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Great. This was a long time in planning.
Absolutely.
Good that we're finally doing it.
Yeah, excited to dive in. Kellen, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Really excited to talk to R.W. and just kind of talk about the C-suite and cannabis events and, you know, all the fun stuff. How are you doing today, Brian?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk to R.W. and talk about some of the learnings that he's found, some of the things that he's learned throughout his journeys that can help so many cannabis companies that are having such challenging decisions, especially now where we are. But R.W., before we dive in, we've got a little East Coast, West Coast battle. And for today, I'd like to know, originally, where were you born? Which coast?
Oh, I was born in the New York area and lived there for until I was nine. My father was also an executive recruiter, and his firm was sold to Korn Ferry way back then. And he had, a non-compete to work in the New York area. And so he went out to move to Los Angeles at that time, and mostly been in Southern California a large part of my career. I also have lived in Alabama, Florida, and the Bay Area up in San Francisco, too.
I appreciate that. But I think, Kellen, just from a birth certificate standpoint, I don't know how he could not be the East Coast.
I mean, but like from a like life percentage perspective, is there loyalties on the West Coast, R.W.?
Yeah, probably more. Like I moved at an age where sports teams, I got pretty involved in the L.A. sports teams.
Oh, well. What's your favorite sports team?
Lakers for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was a Rams fan, but they moved around a lot. And then the Dodgers, I was a big Dodger fan too. And, you know, not so much anymore, but.
All that's getting edited out. He's an East Coaster. We're taking him on the East Coast.
So. Yeah. But I like it. You know, I've been back to New York quite a few times in the last 2 years on business and stuff. And it's great to go back. I've actually had a chance to go back and kind of see where I lived, where I was raised and everything back there and everything. So it's fun.
Maybe we found the connection between Cali products and the East Coast of New York.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the world of the executive recruiting headhunter world was actually created in New York.
It makes sense.
That's where that was invented in New York. So, yeah.
Interesting. So yeah. I guess before we dive in, for our listeners unfamiliar about you, can you give a little background about yourself and then how you got into the cannabis space?
Sure. So I've been an executive recruiter my entire life, the last 8 years focused on cannabis. And previous to that was commercial banking. And as I mentioned, my father was an executive recruiter. I joined him after a couple years stint as a CPA with Pete Marwick Mitchell. It was called Pete Marwick at that time. Now it's KPMG. And I've been retired a couple times, but came back into cannabis about 8 years ago, thought it would be exciting. Main reason I got involved was my son at that time was maybe smoking a little too much, in my opinion. And I wanted to kind of dive in there and let him know this was a business that people were making money at. And it wasn't just, stoners hanging around having fun. So that was my impetus. I got involved and I really enjoyed the people. And I think I saw a big need for what I do. And I'll just tell you quickly. I got started really on the media side. I wrote articles for some of the larger publications like MJ Biz and Marijuana Venture. And what I noticed was that what people in cannabis were calling executive recruiting was really staffing. So they were staffing companies were charging them executive recruiting fees for doing nothing but staffing. And the difference between a real headhunter and staffing is staffing, they just post your job online and they wait for people to come to, you know, answer the call. A headhunter goes and gets your person from one of your competitors. That's the whole point. And the difference is, you know, there are many good people that are looking on job boards and stuff. But if you've got a position where, let's just say, a director of sales, the best directors of sales are probably doing well and very busy where they are. And they're not looking at job boards. If they are, it's probably because they're unemployed or they're about to be unemployed. And so if you want to win with your company, you need to be hiring the, you know, taking people away from one of your competitors that you may have something that they don't have. You might be able to pay them more. The location might be better for them. There could be bonus stock options or something that might make more sense. And that's the way to really do well. And I think cannabis is, over the 8 years that I've been involved, they're starting to understand this, that it's not just getting resumes from a staffing company and hiring somebody for critical roles. Now, there is a level of position where that's fine. I would say, you know, more entry level, up to a certain point. And then after that, they should really be working with a sophisticated executive recruiter. And the fee structure is almost identical. So there's no reason why they wouldn't.
I'm just going to assume that cannabis, which has a likely of a high turnover rate, and these companies, these cannabis companies have limited runways with capital being such a premium. So making these critical decisions are at paramount. So having someone come to you or going to get the right person, the most important characteristics is making sure the person that is selected is the right one for the team. And I think one of the statements that you say that those don't usually get it usually fail. And I'd like you to expand on that.
Yeah, I tell you what I've noticed is that the company, most of the companies, I mean, I almost say just about all companies that I do business with are still in business now, even in California. And, you know, it's been a rough go in the California market. And, you know, so I would say to people that if you don't understand the difference between a headhunter and a staffing company, you're probably going to have trouble making it because you're going to make a lot of mistakes hiring people. And I think that that's absolutely critical. And there are many very seasoned executives in cannabis, and there are some people running companies that they've never really hired people before, so they don't know what the right way to go is. And there's a big difference. And we guarantee our people. So I just think, and I'm not the only person who is good at this, but I think companies need to really understand the difference.
So cannabis hasn't been along for that long. What percentage of recruiting occurs inside the space, and what percentage of recruiting do you have to like look outside of the cannabis space, right? Like there's a lot of similarities in like a director of sales job, right? Yeah. So like, what is that kind of breakdown right now currently?
Well, when they hire me, they want someone who's going to walk in with a Rolodex. Yeah. So if it's in sales, they are already in cannabis at another company. Now, there are positions where they can bring people from out of the industry. I think any financial position, whether it's controller, CFO, VP of finance, staff accountant, those are all pretty transferable skills. Although they would still prefer to have somebody coming from cannabis. But, you know, those are transferable. They could bring somebody from out of the cannabis industry. I think the challenge for people coming from out of the cannabis industry is that if they've been with a startup, they're okay. If they're coming out of big corporate America, they're going to have a major problem trying to fit in because the cannabis industry changes so rapidly. And it's a new industry and it's like a giant startup. So the best candidates, I mean, it's great to have the corporate training, but then maybe you've had one stop at a startup somewhere, so you're used to that startup environment. Yeah, well, I would say other positions. I'm working on a general counsel position right now. That could be coming from out of the cannabis industry for sure. And there are others. Sometimes the operations positions, cannabis. If you think about it, cannabis is made up of what is it? Farming, cultivation, manufacturing. Well, manufacturing is almost like food production. So people can come out of food production to fill some of those roles. And then you also have extraction. And extraction is also can come out of the industry, but there are certainly some unique characteristics where it's good to have cannabis in your background.
Yeah, I think if you're in the cannabis industry, right, and you're looking to hire, there's kind of two different paths. You can hire someone with inexperience, and then they can learn, which is expensive and takes time, or you can pay a little more for someone with experience, which is more expensive, but that learning curve is a little shorter. Both kind of paths lead to the same result, but ultimately the choice is up to the individual. So I'd love to know, RW, how do you guarantee the employees? Like, is it a vetting process that your team goes through? How do you qualify them to understand that someone's skills that they did at another company make them a good fit for the roles that you're going to put them in the future?
Well, at this point, you know, I've been doing this for many decades, and I'm pretty good at looking at a resume and talking to people. You know, after I've looked at a resume and talked and maybe had a Zoom call with a candidate, I pretty much know whether they're for real or not. I mean, that's just the skill set that I think I've acquired. But you like to get people that have a pretty good track record, where they're not hopping jobs. I recently filled a controller position, and the person who'd been in there previous to that had had 5 jobs in 2 years. Now, some of that can be client fault, but I'd say 5 jobs in 2 years is probably the candidate's fault at that point.
So you know, it's really impressive.
Yeah, you look for a little bit, you know, people that are a little more loyal to their employer. And then we do our own background check, and then we also we vet them out with references. We talk to people that they used to work for or work with, et cetera. And sometimes too, knowing which companies they've worked for is big, because I know that certain companies have very strict hiring practices. And if you got hired there, they've somewhat done a little bit of the vetting for us.
Sure. When you're having conversations with people outside the industry, right, and they're curious about cannabis, do you kind of give them the honest truth that the industry is a little harder than they might like? Because sometimes I feel like people outside the industry have this perception of cannabis and how the industry operates. And a lot of the media is pointing it out that these companies are making a ton of money, maybe not so much now from like a public standpoint. And then you kind of get to cannabis and all the tools and the opportunities are a little harder than your most normal and you expect. Do you have these conversations to kind of give them like an honest perspective?
I do. I get calls like this frequently, especially from, you know, corporate people. I remember I got a call from a general counsel in New York, and he said, "I really want to get in the cannabis industry." And we started talking, and I said, "Okay, well, what kind of comp are you looking for?" "Well, I make $500,000 a year," and I'm you know, I was trying to explain to him that the comp is not there yet in cannabis. Someday it will be, but right now, you know, those kinds of high level positions are few and far between. The salaries in cannabis are probably base salary. A lot of cannabis positions are incentivized, where the base may not be that fantastic, but there's a bonus and equity package that's part of the deal. And so I'd say that cannabis is lagging a little bit to more competitive industries right now. And when it does eventually get legalized, when safe banking comes in and there'll be a lot more capital in the industry, and some of those changes will make the industry much more profitable. I mean, I think when they do away with 280E, people have told me that every cannabis company will be worth twice as much now that they can deduct the same things that other companies can do. So if you combine that with an influx of capital, that's a different ballgame.
Like a magic wand just instantly makes the industry.
It could happen this fall or maybe not, but you know, it's on the table again, both rescheduling and safe banking. So
again, my favorite aspect of it is we're not expecting different rules and regulations everywhere else. We just want to have normal practices like every other industry.
Right.
Just standard expectations for what I need.
Yeah, and reasonable tax structure.
Right. Just reasonable. Just give us like a fair chance here. Kind of expanding on that, one would assume when these companies come to you and they're expecting you to have a long Rolodex, that probably leads really nicely into the Canapac and kind of the origin of that. Can you take us through how that was formed and how the two of them integrate together?
Sure. So during COVID, I started a Zoom call because the webinars that I went to, I found were really pretty boring, and they were the same structure over and over again. They would have a half an hour webinar and they'd have one expert talk for 10 minutes and then another one for 10 minutes. And I was like, "Woo, I'm ready to go to sleep." So we decided we wanted to do something different, and we made our Zoom call much more interactive. We wouldn't let anybody speak for more than a minute or two. It was all Q&A. And so we did that for, God, at least a year and a half every week. And I developed a pretty loyal following. And as soon as we could, we said, well, let's go in person. And coming out of COVID, we wanted to go to places where people would be comfortable in person. So we went outdoor rooftops. And we started in Oakland, and we gravitated between Southern California and Northern California. And then as time went on, we went out to Arizona. And then we've been to New York, Washington, D.C., Miami, Chicago, New Jersey, and you know, really spread out to where we're national now. We go probably once a month, at least, maybe twice a month. And the whole idea, another thing that was, I've been to so many events. I've been to literally every conference, and people will recognize me and know that they know that I've been to every conference. For the last 8 years, it seems like I've gone to every single one. And when I noticed that some of the ones that were more elite, that the only people showing up were people selling services into the industry, not the people that were actually operators. So the Canna Pack, we focus totally on operators. And the event, it's invite only, and it's paid for by the sponsors. So the only vendors or people selling services are really the sponsors. And everyone else, we try to get very interesting people, but we really try to focus on operators, the people that are actually in the cannabis industry, whether they own a chain of dispensaries, whether they are cultivators, extractors, manufacturers, whatever their angle is, that's who we try to get to show up. And we've tried to keep it at the C-suite level. So it's CEOs, CFOs, founders, managing partners, you know, people like that. And they do business together. They do a lot of business at these events. I mean, I can tell you there's a number of companies that have been bought and sold by meeting people at these events. And it's very low key. We try to keep the sponsors low key, but people, you know, they get to see what the sponsors are actually all about and what they do. And I think it's been a great business development tool for me and for the sponsors. We try to keep the sponsors at 4 at the most, and we spread the costs amongst those 4 sponsors.
Give us some insight to the event for those who haven't attended. Potentially, if you're a sponsor, do you get access to the guest list? Do you get to do a presentation? How do you influence the right people to benefit your organization when kind of funding the event to make it worthwhile for all the parties?
So sponsors, number one, we post about them on LinkedIn. We send emails to our list about who's sponsoring, especially before the event, including pictures. So they recognize the people when they get there. When they get to the event, they can bring their team with them. Sponsors can bring their team. And then I will go out of my way and my ambassador, we have 2 people that act as ambassadors for me at these events. They memorize the list. They know the sponsors. So they will actually walk the people to the sponsor. And, you know, we're very good at that. I'm very good at that. And I think that that allows the sponsor to come out away from these events with 4 or 5 conversations that are going to go, you know, to another step.
Do you guys theme these meetings as far as like one is more focused on cultivation potentially and kind of try to tailor it like that?
No, they're pretty much just high level executive happy hours generally, you know, and the idea is we go to you. So everywhere we go, most of the people are probably driving from within 1 hour to the event. Some people follow our events and they fly to all of them. But in general, we're coming to you, and it's an evening event. Usually we start at 5 or 6 o'clock and we go for about 3 hours. And it's we have stopped for announcements. So, you know, the problem is the events are going so good and everybody's engaged that I'm sort of hesitant about whether to actually stop the events and recognize people, because that almost signals like, okay, is that the end of the event? And, you know, when things are going really well, I don't want to touch it. So I kind of go back and forth on that myself. We have done announcements at some events. Some events are sort of perfect for that and some aren't. it just kind of depends. But and then I'll do follow-up emails, LinkedIn posts, and we'll do whatever we can to support the sponsors.
I want to go back to what you said about the person who memorized the list and then kind of walks the individuals through the sponsors. I think that's such an important, delicate balance too, because the sponsors that are investing capital into it need to have that kind of potential ROI from that to make it worthwhile for them to consider in the future. And that's such a challenging balance then to see that person in the room who you are looking to speak to, and that you have some sort of opportunity to connect that isn't like that cold, uncomfortable conversation, and having that handoff, kind of like a concierge service, makes that interaction, that first one, so important, because it is like that handoff introduction that makes both parties feel like this conversation is necessary.
Yeah. And we also, the sponsors get to invite people. So really, if you look at what the cost of what the sponsorship cost is, and sponsorship costs are somewhere between, let's say, $2,500 and $6,000. At $5,000 or $6,000, you can be the lead sponsor at most of these events. And depending on your level of sponsorship, you can invite as many people as you want. So effectively, let's say you have clients, and it's almost like you're entertaining them for free, really. I mean, by being a sponsor. I mean, if you're bringing in, let's say, if you're a $2,500 sponsor, you bring 10 guests, if you looked at the way where we go, these exotic restaurants and everything's top notch, you're going to spend $100, $150 per person entertaining those people anyway. So the sponsorship's almost like free, at that point, if you're organized enough to get the right people to show up to the event.
So how do you get those right people to show up at the event? Because it's one thing for the sponsor to invite. It's another thing to help secure the individuals to attend, which I'm sure your team kind of helps that balance between the two parties.
Well, I have 22,000 followers on LinkedIn, and they all come from cannabis. I started this profile when in the cannabis industry, and they're all mostly all C-level executives. So no matter where we go, I have a pretty strong following of people that I invite to the events, and from our guest lists from previous events. So they, and that's the one of the draws, is they want to be in front of those people. Then I always ask the sponsors, okay, who do you want to attend? And then I will make sure that we get the word out to those people. And then when people, we will periodically send the guest list out to people. And when they see who's on the guest list, then people decide, hey, I want to be part of that. And so it all just kind of works its way to a perfect situation.
Do you have any success stories you can share between two parties that maybe didn't know each other or ended up meeting and doing some business, that to give others some insight into the type of conversations and experiences?
Well, one that immediately comes to mind is that Greenfield Cannabis was sold to Stizzy Shrine Group at one of my events, a series of my events. The introductions, the whole thing kind of happened at that. And there have been others too. Leaf Holdings took over Iconic Brands, and that was that happened at my events. So there's a number of stories like that, and then there have been many executives who have found positions and companies finding people, etc., vice versa.
Who do you think would benefit from these events that is not currently attending them?
Well, I would say companies in different areas. There are always companies that, even like, let's say we got to Arizona, there are a couple of companies that I'm just being introduced to now that have not attended, who really should be attending. They're going nationwide. I would say anybody that's going nationwide in cannabis should be considering this, either attending or as a sponsor. And we'll invite most companies, we'll allow them to have one or two people. And then after a while, we'll kind of ask them to sponsor, or if they want to bring more, if they want to bring their sales team, then they really need to be a sponsor of the event.
What's the biggest pushback people aren't interested in participating? Is it capital? Is there another reason?
No, I don't really get much of a pushback other than that people, they just don't know about it. I think most people that know about it, and once they come, they enjoy it. And usually we have a hotel that's associated. For example, when we do our event in West Hollywood, we go to a restaurant called EP&LP, and they have a, a rooftop that overlooks all of the mountains there in Hollywood and West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. And then about about 9 o'clock, we go back to Petit Hermitage, where everybody stays overnight, and we're able to get a preferred rate. And it's quite an exotic Hollywood type place where just about anything will happen on the rooftop. And I think we've seen anything happen on the rooftop late at night. I remember one of our events, we were there, and Woody Harrelson was having his birthday party. And of course, he's a big cannabis guy. He owns a dispensary called The Woods. And so when he found out who we were, next thing you know, we merged, and everybody was right in the middle of his birthday party. And, that's the kind of stuff that happens at Petit. So we go to there at least twice a year, and I don't get much pushback. It's just, getting the right kinds of people. Again, we could fill this event up with people trying to sell things into the industry, but we really want the people that are running the industry, the decision makers that run cannabis wherever we go.
So what's the cap? How do you guys cap it?
I have to play. That's a real work of art, which I've been very lucky at. Yeah, it's crazy because I'm able to just adjust it really by the amount of emails, reminders that I send out. Like if I see that we're getting too crowded, I stop sending reminders. And maybe there might be 3 days go by right up to the event where, hey, people say we still having this event. Yeah, we're having it, but and I have to do that in West Hollywood sometimes, tone it down a little because it gets a little out of control. But we try to keep it at the larger events, somewhere between 100 and 125. And we're at a space where you can see everybody at the event. So you're safe. I'll get to you. I'll come over to you later. But if you get more than 125, I feel like it loses. You get to the point where you can't possibly meet everybody. And I don't know what that number is. I think it's 125, 140, anything more than that.
That's what psychology says, right? 150.
It's too many people.
Yeah.
And then there's certain venues we go to where it's a little smaller, but that's what's worked for us.
It's definitely a balanced feel, it seems like, kind of like an artistical touch, understanding the players involved, the conversation, the location, the kind of the goal of the event. And then for you to kind of aggressively trying to pursue people inside that field and then have that balance to go a little more and a little not. But it seems like if you don't get an email close to the event and we're kind of maxed out, RW doesn't really want you there.
Well, it's more about keeping the crowd. Once you're on the list, you're on the list. And, anybody who, accepts, that's great. But it's a little bit different. And look, we're just approaching this. I'm trying to protect the sponsors. They want to make deals at these events. They want to do business with somebody. Same thing with me. We want to have fun, but we also want to do business. And so it's kind of an art. And it's worked out really well. And I think that, we have a strong following. The people that are in the area, they like to come and they want to come back. I really haven't had, any real blowback. I'm trying to think of anything that's come up. It's challenging getting sponsors in this cannabis economy. But people have to remember that, like in New York and New Jersey, they're doing quite well. They're just getting started whereas maybe there's some people struggling in California, some people aren't struggling in California. There are some people that are doing quite well. So we've really haven't had too much trouble getting sponsorship. I mean, we're certainly aware of the general mood in the cannabis industry, which I'd say it's lukewarm. The new markets are going strong, and there are pockets. There are companies in every market. I'm actually quite busy in California with my executive recruiting, because there are a handful of players that are doing very well.
That's great to hear. So what is the most expensive lesson you've learned?
Wow, at the events or in executive recruiting?
What's the first one that came to mind?
Interesting. Well, I would say, we ran an event in New York, and, one thing I have to do when I'm running these events, I want to have a very close relationship with the people running it, and the people I want them to want us. And at this event in New York, it was more of like, you're lucky to have us. And we were sort of treated that way. And so I wouldn't say it was by far our most expensive event. It cost $25,000 to put this event on, and it was just a, you know, 3-hour happy hour, you know. But I would say that, you know, having a good relationship with the venues, it was new for me setting up. I knew where to go, and I knew how to run a party and all that, but dealing directly with these restaurants and negotiating contracts with them and stuff, that was, you know, I had to learn maybe the hard way.
Good old New York right there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Tough cookies.
Dream smoking session, 3 people dead or alive.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I always turn on whatever I can find, whatever interview. I love Emily Blunt. So I would love to go have some cannabis and talk to her sometime. That would be for sure. That's a tough question. You're going to put me on the spot here. Cannabis people.
It could be anybody. It doesn't have to just be cannabis people. It could be former president.
Famous figures or, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know everybody raps on this guy, but everyone that I've ever met who's actually spent time with him thinks he's the greatest guy in the world. Bill Clinton, I think it would be entertaining to have a little smoke with him, you know, and people tell me that he's very, when you're in the room with him and you're talking to him, he's the greatest guy in the world. And I'm not so sure about his partner, but I had a great car ride and it was involved in the cannabis industry. I drove Pim Fox from Santa Barbara to San Jose. And he has a show on Bloomberg every day, or he did at that time. And he'd interviewed just about everybody. And I drove him up to, and we had 5 hours in the car, and we were talking about everything. And we were talking about the Clintons. And he said, Raymond, imagine that you had never stopped for a red light in 25 years. What do you think you'd be like? And so it kind of summed it up. But let me see if there's a third. We got to a third. I'll have to think. I don't want to hold you up. It'll come to me later on here.
Yeah. I just want to say for the record, I'd like to never stop at a red light ever again. Also,
I saw that just the other day in LA. The whole freeway was jammed up, and it was, I believe, the VP, and she must have been going to Burbank Airport or Van Nuys Airport, and. Wow, they had that. It was crazy. It was like OJ on the freeway. I mean, the whole freeway was shut down except for this motorcade, and obviously not making the Angelinos very happy because it shut down the freeway for a few minutes. You got a real problem.
Yeah, not great. When you got started in your cannabis journey, what did you get right? Most importantly, what did you get wrong?
Well, I think I got right, as I mentioned, exactly that people did not understand the difference between staffing and executive recruiting. I was absolutely right about that. And I've gradually been able to educate them to the point where, you know, we're, you know, solidly busy. And I think that we'll be more and more busy. So it was a good move, a little bit of a chancy move. Most people in my world, executive recruiting world, were all afraid to jump in. They're almost still afraid to jump in because it's not legal. What did I get right? What did I get wrong? I would say that maybe something that people don't know, and I may have thought this in the beginning, there are a lot of very solid business people that are involved in cannabis. You know, many of the owners of these companies have been very successful in other endeavors. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, mentioned a couple of Democrat people. I'm sort of agnostic, but many of the people that own cannabis companies are actually Republicans. And that's something that people would not think, and I've told that in there, so I think it's important that you service your client and forget about all that kind of nonsense of who's who and just respect people for what they've done and what they've accomplished, so that I would say that what I got wrong, I would have, and I think most people coming into cannabis would have assumed that everybody in cannabis was liberal and progressive. And, you know, that's definitely not the case.
We hear often rich. People think that the industry is full of companies making money and the individuals within it making a ton of money. The green rush was what they referred to, but also not true about the industry.
Well, there's a number of people that have done very, very well.
But they've been in it for probably a long amount of time and have probably dealt with ups and downs.
Exactly.
Right? They haven't been those quick to rush in, put in a ton of money, and not gotten that ROI back that they had originally.
Yeah.
All right, RW, prediction time. Considering your extensive experience in connecting C-suite executives and founders within the cannabis industry, how do you foresee the leadership landscape evolving in the coming decade? What qualities or skills do you predict will be most vital for future leaders in the cannabis space?
Well, I think for sure, I think that successful executives are going to have a pretty solid background in finance. Right now, raising capital is very difficult. So people have to be very good. If they're running a company, they have to be very good at raising capital. And that almost defines the winners and losers. If you cannot raise capital, you're going to go out of business pretty quick. So I would say, and then being a good steward of that capital and having a track record of being that are very important characteristics. I think one thing, the industry, there's a lot of people that react very quickly. I think maybe going forward, there's going to be a little bit more where the leader of the company, let's say, for example, you have somebody that's not performing. A lot of times right now in the cannabis industry, they'll make a knee-jerk reaction, boom, get rid of them. Whereas it might have been easier to sit the person down early, you know, quickly and have that conversation of like, here's what we need from you. These are the deliverables that you've got to give us. Can you do it? And have that conversation, then give them some kind of runway. I'll tell you a story that I tell people. I placed a very high-level head of sales, and the CEO wanted to fire him after 30 days. And I said, well, I don't know. I think you got to give this guy a little more time. And I actually talked to the candidate, and he was beside himself. He said, look, this is going to take 60, 90 days to get this right. Well, long story short, they kept him on. And he brought in $30 million in revenue in like about a year and a half's time. He made the company. And I think a little bit more of that, I mean, you know, take your time, hire the right person, and then give them a chance to succeed. And I'm not saying that these executives are not always right. Many times they're right with right away. They're saying, hey, this is not going to work out. But I think they should give people a little bit more of a runway. And I know they're under pressure, financial pressure, time pressure from their investors. So it's tough, but I think that's a characteristic going forward that'll be necessary as the industry becomes a more mature and more like a traditional business.
I think that's great advice. Kellen.
I do think that's great advice that RW shared. I think maybe grit is probably the only thing I could think of going through it, just because the cannabis industry is going to continue to be challenging, I think, especially for probably the next 5 years. My guess is it's going to take 5 years for the playing field to at least be leveled so that you're at least competing as like a normal business with the tools that everyday businesses currently have, like loans and access to banking and all these other fun things, right? So I think that it's just going to take grit, because you're going to have to be able to manage a ton of unknowns. You're going to be raising capital in a really challenging market, and you can't write any expenses off, and you're selling technically a Scheduled One product that the government isn't even recognizing right now. So like, there's a lot of challenges still, and in order to overcome them, it's just going to take sheer grit, in my opinion. What do you think, Brian?
I think both those are really good answers. I think lean and mean. I think with the challenges the industry face, like understanding, you know, profitability and ROI of some of these efforts will be really crucial in what separates these companies. And specifically what comes to mind is understanding some efficiency numbers, right? I think cannabis is full of so many unknown variables, but there are variables during the internal operational process that you can lock in. And when you do lock those in, you can make sound, good financial business decisions, which I think more companies will have to start doing, because as we've seen, the capital start to gone away. There's a lot of incoming variables, so you need to really understand your numbers so you can make those prudent decisions, exactly like you said, RW.
Excellent. Yeah, I agree. And I think I have a little brighter optimism about the industry. I think people don't realize how quickly these things can turn around. Let's take the last big downturn was, I think, 19 into early 20. it was sort of the end of 19. I remember coming out of MJ Biz, and then it was the beginning of 1920. It was definitely dead for, you know, 3-4 months or so. And I don't see that happening because there's so many new markets opening up, at least for what I do. There's action going on, and I think we'll just roll right into it. And then one of these things, the safe banking, rescheduling, legalization, that'll suddenly fuel California again, even the speculation of it. So while while these other hot markets may die out a little, the markets that have been depressed will suddenly be in better shape. And that's kind of the way I see this rolling going forward.
I think that's a perfect way to end it off, because I think that's the optimism that a lot of these listeners are looking to hear, especially from someone that sits in your vantage point, understanding and connecting the dots with some of the leadership's biggest players. So RW, for our listeners, they want to learn more about the Canna Pack, they want to visit you on LinkedIn, or they want to attend one of the events, where can they find you?
Yes, well, they can hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm r.w.navis on LinkedIn. My website is rwnavis.com. And the website for the events is the Canna Pack, PAC. So it's the Canna, CANNAPAC.com. And just get in touch. Let me know how you want to get involved.
Awesome. We'll link it up in the show notes. Thanks for taking the time. This was a lot of fun.
Good deal. Enjoyed it.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Infused, a cannabis talk show, is a one-of-a-kind look inside the cannabis industry. Meet the amazing people who make cannabis businesses bloom as they join host Nick with Francesca and Mike for creative cannabis conversations. Get an honest look at the business of cannabis, including trends, best and worst practices, products, education, and advocacy. Whether you're canna curious or running a cannabis, Infused has canna conversations that count. Infused is available on YouTube and is now streaming as part of the PodConnects Network.